Thank you. Welcome to all of you. And I'm really happy to see a full room to welcome our colleague today, Dr. Christine Berberich from the University of Portsmouth. Christine's speciality falls into 20th and 21st century English and European literatures. Her research interests are divided between cultural constructions of national identity, in particular English and Britishness, and cultural commemorations of the Holocaust and trauma. She's the author of several works, and the editor of several works, so I've made a selection. I'll mention the Bloomsbury Introduction to Popular Fiction from 2014, because I really like it. And there's also Trauma and Memory, the Holocaust in Contemporary Culture from 2021. In a different subject, there's Brexit and the Migrant Voice, EU Citizens in Post-Brexit Literature and Culture, from 2022. And at the moment, she's working on two projects. The first one is a book on P.G. Woodhouse, on the novelist P.G. Woodhouse and the civilian internment camp at Tofte. And the other project is a monograph on Nazi noir. Okay?
Thank you very much, Armin. Thank you. Thank you. I have to say, the Brexit book is the one I really wish I didn't have to write, but unfortunately that stupid thing happened, so we had to write a book about it. So first of all, thank you very much to Armel and Bertrand for the very kind invitation to address you all here, to try out my new research, so to speak. I'm very much looking forward to getting questions or comments or book suggestions from you afterwards. It's very nice to be back here at Caen. And it's a lovely venue that I love returning to, I have to say. So, as you know, my paper today is entitled Nazi Noir. It's part of a new monograph I've been working on for a number of years now, and my bookshelf is literally groaning under the weight of books because there are so many on that topic that are being published every week. There's new fiction coming out all the time. So I'll be talking about that a little bit. In particular, this fiction is coming out of Germany. Doesn't necessarily exist in English translation, but there is now also increasingly new fiction coming out of the Anglophone world and other European countries. So this is generally fiction that in one way or another creatively engages with the Nazi past. So I'll explain this a little bit more further on. But to give you an idea of what I'm going to cover in today's presentation, so I'm going to propose a number of different points. First of all, that the writing of historical crime novels is a good way to widen the knowledge about Nazi crimes by drawing in readers who might not necessarily want to read about the Third Reich and its crimes otherwise. There's obviously a very different demographic when it comes to reading crime fiction than there might be when it comes to reading highbrow historical fiction or historical works in the first place. Secondly, I'm going to propose that novels investigating crime linked to the Nazis are an effective way of dealing with the past and acknowledging a collective but also a personal complicity in crimes that urgently needs to be addressed. And that finally, this helps readers to engage with the past in different ways by often jolting us out of our complacency by offering surprising or shocking twists that ultimately help us to think about our ingrained notions of right and wrong and victim and perpetrator. So what I'm going to do over the next 45 to 60 minutes, I didn't time it, is first of all to outline the recent title, Nazi Noir, how I'm reading or interpreting that term. I'll follow this up with a working definition of the term to set out the issue of complicity and its various manifestations and how I'm proposing to apply it to select texts. And then finally, to offer you a couple of case studies from recent novels I've been working on. So I'm very aware that probably you're not going to be familiar with all or indeed any of the novels I'm talking about. So a lot of what I'm presenting today is also going to be quite descriptive, so you actually understand the context of those novels. So I will start with a brief survey of some recent crime and detective novels that deal with the Nazi past. So it's important in this context to situate these novels in the realm of popular culture, which is often derided and considered of lesser importance than its canonical cousins, the highbrow literature. So, however, I take my cue from Scott McCracken, who argues that, I should be on the slide, that popular fiction can tell us much about who we are and about the society in which we live. So novels investigating Nazi crimes come from a variety of cultural backgrounds. Prominent British and American authors here include, for instance, Philip Kerr with his well-known Bernie Gunther series. I think he might be the one name that you might have heard of. There's also an author called Nicholas Freeling, who has created a successful series of novels focusing on Inspector van der Valk. There is Robert Wilson with his novel A Small Death in Lisbon of 1999. Rory Clement's recent work, Munich Wolf, or Rebecca Cantrell's A Trace of Smoke, as well as Jonathan Rapp's Shadow and Light, or David Thomas's Ostland. So some of these novels are now even hitting supermarket bookshelves in Britain. So, for instance, the Munich Wolf one, which is very prominent on the slide one, is one that greeted me in my local Tesco's a week ago. I had never even heard of it before. I wandered past the bookshelf. I went, oh, this looks like it's a Nazi book. I read the blurb and I went, yeah, okay, I'll put that in my shopping trolley then. So I haven't read it yet, but it deals with similar issues to what I've been dealing with in other books. There are successful examples from Italy, for instance, such as, so I have a thing about Italy, so I'm always keen to talk about the Italian ones, such as Carlo Lucarelli's successful trilogy around Commissario De Luca, which has been turned into a successful TV series, and Maurizio Di Giovanni's series around Commissario Ricciardi, which has been turned into a TV series, or also Bruno Morchio's novel The German Client, which is called Rosamaro in the Italian original. They're not necessarily that well known, but they're very well worth reading. There are also some Scandinavian examples. For instance, Henning Mankell has written the novel The Return of the Dancing Master. So this is an example from Sweden, or Joe Nesbø's The Redbreast from Norway. If you know of any French examples, please tell me. I haven't yet found anything that can fit into that kind of category of novels from France, and I'm really, really keen to find some examples. So far, the majority of texts I've been reading and investigating come from Germany, where they're so prolific that it seems new titles are published on a weekly basis. So I think at some point I'll just have to say, basta, I've read enough. So following McCracken's above-quoted line that popular fiction can tell us much about who we are and about the society in which we live, this suggests that there is a real, ongoing, and after 75 years, still very urgent drive in Germany to critically engage with the crimes of the past. So there is this beautiful, beautiful German word. Those of you who speak German, you might know that Germans have a real thing for very short words, such as Vergangenheitsbewältigung, which in English needs lots of words. It's coming to terms with the past. So we could possibly argue that this Vergangenheitsbewältigung does not stop at popular fiction, but uses it cleverly to ask difficult questions and involve a wide readership at the same time. There are countless authors, for instance, Bernard Schling, Christian von Ditfurth, Ferdinand von Schirach, Ulrich Ritzel, Bernward Schneider, etc., etc., etc. There's a lot of them. They have all created standalone works of detective fiction or highly successful series with detectives who again and again have to investigate the crimes of the past and their link to the present. You might have heard of one example. One of these successful series that have been translated into English are Volker Kutscher's series, Babylon Berlin, which has been turned into an absolutely mind-blowingly fantastic TV series. There is a bit of a theme here with the TV series. So, as I said before, I'm aware that for most of you, these authors might be entirely unknown. Many of their works are also not available in English translation. Nevertheless, it is perhaps relevant even at this early point to start with a potentially slightly generalizing value statement. So I say potentially here, as I haven't finished reading all of those novels. However, the trend as I currently see it is that in particular, English language Nazi noir is written in a more sensationalist and possibly slightly well-researched manner, maybe trying to tick the boxes of mass interest in anything to do with the Second World War, which certainly holds power in the UK, but also in the US. Might be an unkind assessment. I might have to revise that in a year's time or so, but at the moment, that's my impression. I would then say that German and Italian Nazi noir, by comparison, seems to be a lot more introspective, far better researched, and consequently asking more searching and self-critical questions, both within the fiction, the novels themselves, but also of the readers, in particular as far as collective and individual complicity and guilt are concerned. So I'm hoping to prove this point later on with my case studies. So for my project, I have adopted the term Nazi noir. Noir, or hard-boiled, was a term first used for crime writing in the 1930s with novels such as James Hadley Chase's No Orchids for Miss Blandish of 1939, for instance. This is fiction that foregrounds often brutal and graphic murders in gruesome detail. And interestingly, in his critique of the new genre, George Orwell suggested that the reading public's fascination with hard-boiled crime already suggested a fascist sensibility by offering an interconnection between sadism, masochism, success worship, power worship, nationalism, and totalitarianism. So nevertheless, since its first appearance on the scene, noir crime writing has been consistently popular with readers, now by extension also by viewers, because most crime drama on TV is more of the hard-boiled than the cozy crime variety, because readers potentially prefer this graphic genre to its more tame relation. It is this noir genre that was then also adapted by Philip Kerr, for instance, from the late 1980s onwards. His series of Bernie Gunther novels merge, in the words of Petra Rau, historical fiction and hard-boiled style for dramatizing and exoticizing fascist Germany. So, of course, the term exoticizing here is really important, as it suggests a distancing from the reality of fascist Germany in favor of a more, shall we say, creative approach that allows the readers to be taken in by a rollicking narrative rather than critically engaging with the historical context. But more of this further on. For the sake of this paper, the important thing is to know that crime fiction set in the Weimar Republic, in Nazi Germany, or Nazi-occupied Europe seemed to plug the gap left by the suddenly outdated Cold War spy thriller. So, there are potentially, and broadly speaking, two general trends in these crime novels. There are those that are set in the past and that deal with historical figures, both real and imaginary, and there are those that are set in the relative present but look backwards from a vantage point of historical hindsight and investigate contemporary crimes with a link to the past. The first category of novels are generally referred to as straightforward historical crime fiction. Quote, set entirely in some particular historical time period, but not written during the period. There we go. To give you a couple of very, very brief examples, both Bernward Schneider and Uwe Klausner from Germany have written such historical novels. Schneider's Berlin Potsdamer Platz of 2013 is set in the run-up to the Rümputsch, the Night of Long Knives of 1934. As such, it has real historical settings that refers to actual historical figures, yet also introduces fictional characters who solve a fictional crime. To give you another example, Klausner's Bernstein Connection of 2011 is the third volume in an ongoing series focusing on Commissar Tom Sydow of the West Berlin Kriminalpolizei. So most of these novels are actually set post-war. Set predominantly in the 1950s, in the early stages of the Cold War, at whose center was the divided post-war Berlin, the novel revolves around the various conspiracy theory concerning the famous Bernstein Zimmer, which is the Amber Room. There's a lot of sort of post-war myths surrounding this. It was this fantastically opulent room that apparently the Nazis dismantled and hid somewhere during the war to protect it. And then after the war, it was gone. Nobody knows where it was hidden. So there are all of these rumors that maybe it perished in a bomb attack. Other people say, no, it's still there somewhere in some underground cave. It is waiting to be rediscovered. It was basically looted from St. Petersburg by the Nazis and is now gone. The novel thus focuses on factual historical events, the looting of the Bernstein Zimmer, etc., etc., and in narrative flashbacks to the war introduces real-life characters such as Heinrich Himmler, for instance. These novels are more or less educational in that they introduce facts about the war and Nazi crimes to a wider audience. They deal with the past, but they wear their engagement with the past relatively lightly. So the entertainment via the crime case and the crime investigation stands a little bit more in the foreground. However, The second category of novels are more complex, and from the point of view of the nice long German word Vergangenheitsbewältigung, coming to terms with the past, far more interesting. These novels attempt to solve fictional contemporary crimes that refer back to the Nazi past. In many cases, these contemporary crimes have been carried out to revenge crimes committed by the Nazis. In other cases, they are committed to cover up Nazi crimes decades after the actual events that could still implicate historical perpetrators and their descendants decades later. Bruce Murphy refers to these works as transhistorical crime fiction. As Achim Sauper has shown, in these novels, the emphasis is on detection that uncovers the ambivalence of history, memory, and remembrance that leads back to the past. Rather than merely solving the crime, novels such as these reflect on how history has been passed down and commemorated, and how that engages with individual choices, both in the past and in the present. So the majority of German Nazi noir novels falls into this category, at least the majority of the ones I've read so far. A particularly prominent example here is the 7-volume Stachelmann series by Christian von Ditfurth. So Christian von Ditfurth is actually a professor of history himself with a research specialism in the Nazi past. He really knows what he's writing about. And his novels focus on the, surprise, surprise, aspiring history professor, Josef Maria Stachelmann, who is repeatedly drawn into solving crime cases that have their origins in the Nazi past. So the first two of this series, only the first of the series actually translated into English. However, the first two of the series are actually available in French. And as we say so nicely in English, excuse my French, Un homme irréprochable, la première enquête criminelle de Stachelmann, and Frappé d'aveuglement. So you can check them out in French if you so wish, or in German if you read German. They're fantastic. They're really very, very good. So what I'm going to do for the remainder of today's talk is offer you a glimpse into the straightforward historical narrative via a brief discussion of Philip Kerr, Bernie Gunther novels, followed by an assessment of some example of this second later category. Before this, however, we need to consider the term complicity, as it's a key term in any discussion of Nazi noir novels. I'm here basing my discussion on Gregory Malema's definition of the term. So he says, when someone is complicit in the wrongdoing of a principal actor, then that person is also guilty of wrongdoing. This sounds pretty straightforward, right? So if one of your friends says, I'm going to, I don't know, lift a sandwich in the supermarket, and you go, yeah, all right, I'll come with you, then that makes you complicit. You might not be the one doing the actual stealing, but you're there with them. So you're complicit. Malema also suggests that the notion of complicity is almost always applied to situations in which the outcome has a negative moral status. So people very rarely say that they're complicit in something that's positive. So complicity is usually associated with something that is negative, and most of the time it's associated with a crime and misdemeanor. So complicity always suggests going along with or supporting something that has negative ethical or moral connotations. That's really quite important, the ethical and moral connotations that most of the time appear to be obvious from the start. So most people try to say afterwards, oh, I wasn't really aware. But, you know, if somebody asks you to come along while they're stealing a sandwich, surely on your moral radar, you know, this is not the right thing to do, to put it very simply. So complicity, according to Malema, is thus a choice. He says, one does not become complicit in wrongdoing simply by being in the wrong place at the wrong time or by being a member of a certain clan. It is important to emphasize this at the beginning of this discussion. After the war, of course, many of the Nazi perpetrators who were prosecuted tried to defend themselves with the fact that they had just followed orders. However, in Malema's definition, following orders is always a conscious choice. In the discussion of my case studies below, the main characters do not become complicit by following orders, but by other conscious choices they make during the course of the narrative or just prior to it. This is obviously, and for reasons of space and time management, just a very short and probably vastly simplified definition of complicity, but I'm hoping to further illustrate this in my textual analysis. So then, finally, we're getting to some of the texts. Let us start with Philip Kerr's best-selling and popular series of Berlin noir novels, focusing on the hard-boiled investigator Bernie Gunther. Now, I'll tell you up front, They're not very good novels. If you want a rollicking narrative, you get that. If you want to read about crime that is quite gruesome in its depiction, that has quite intricate methods of investigation, you get that. However, if you want novels that are sexist, misogynist, racist, you also get that. So they're also not very well written. But they have been best-selling novels in Britain, so and across the world, actually. The first one was published in 1989 with the title March Violets. So March Violets, and I should just explain, March Violets is the term given to those people who joined the Nazi Party immediately after Hitler came to power. So Hitler came to power at the end of January 1933, and these were people who then rushed to join the party in February and in March of 1933. After that, the Nazis went, no, we're stopping people joining the party now because there are so many, and they might not be serious in their ideological investment, for instance. So March Violets are those people. March Violets is the first in a series now comprising 14 novels that only ended with the author's death in 2018. They cover much ground, both in terms of location, with settings, for instance, ranging from Berlin as the center of the Nazi Reich to Munich to Vienna, as well as further flung locations such as Havana, Argentina, Prague, Croatia, Greece, and the French Riviera. So I suspect that as his novels sold quite well and he earned money, he decided to have long vacations in those places and then sort of started weaving them into his narratives. They also cover a lot of sort of temporal space, a lot of big time span, with a narrative stretching over decades, largely following a chronological approach, taking Günther from 1936 to 1957. Occasionally, there are flashbacks to earlier periods. So much for the background to the novels, but let's now look at how they could be read. In a review article of Prussian Blue, the 12th installment of the Bernie Gunther series, published in 2017, Jane Kramer, writing for The New Yorker, labels Gunther as the Third Reich's good cop. Oop, here we have him. And asks in her subheading, why do we like him so much? At which point I asked myself, what is she on about? So not wishing to keep my readers in suspense, I will say up front that I really disagree quite strongly with Günther's label as the Third Reich's good cop, and that I at least don't find him very likable at all. I will argue throughout that engaging with Kerr's private investigator at such an emotive level is, given the novel's setting and subject matter, highly problematic, if not outright contentious. Because he is a private investigator. He works for the Nazis. You know, how can we like him? To put it very simply, I will focus on the first three novels in the series, commonly referred to as the Berlin Noir Trilogy, including March Violets, The Pale Criminal, which was then first published in 1990, and The German Requiem of 1991. So you can also see he published three novels within 3 years. So he really did churn them out. He found his formula and he stuck to it. These novels chart Günther's progression from 1936 to 1938, skipping over the immediate war years and fast-forwarding to 1947 in the third installment. So in the course of these three novels, Günther not only successfully investigates crimes, but also, though admittedly mostly against his will, becomes more and more embroiled in the machinations and manipulations of the Nazi state that bring him into close personal contact with Nazi leaders, ranging from Hermann Göring and Reinhard Heydrich to Martin Bormann. So these real characters also appear in the novels and actually have speaking parts in the novels as well. So we can consequently say immediately that Günther, through personal choices, makes himself complicit in the machinations of the Third Reich. But rather than providing a mere review, I will address a number of specific issues here. First of all, Günther's credentials as a hardboiled detective. Then secondly, the historical verisimilitude in the novels. And finally, the corruption of social life and personal ethics during the Third Reich with reference to complicity. So Bernie Günther, we can say straight away, is a tough cookie and a typical hard-boiled detective. His credentials are considerably. He has heroically fought in the First World War and was even awarded an Iron Cross for his courage in battle. He has lost his wife, his first wife, to the Spanish flu and has mourned her ever since, which does not stop him, however, from pursuing women for pleasure in every single book. He ends up in bed with a different woman in every book. He is cynical and world-weary, yet also cocky and outspoken. He is open about his dislike of the Nazi Party and what it stands for, although he works for them. At the same time, he's a realist. Kramer, the critic Kramer, refers to the radical pragmatism of Günther's moral compass, which is key to neither outrage nor indifference. So he sees horrible things happening around him, and he doesn't really engage with it. He doesn't really comment on it. There is no sense that he is outraged or shocked or dismayed or happy about what he sees around him. And this is key to Günther's drive to survive and explains the fact that he is repeatedly prepared to compromise considerably on his morals, or in other words, to become complicit in Nazi crimes. Günther refers to himself as no knight in shining armor, just a weather-beaten man in a crumpled overcoat on a street corner with only a grey idea of something you might well go ahead and call morality. And he writes morality with a capital M here, suggesting he feels strongly about it, but there isn't really any evidence. It is comments such as these that are meant to make it easier for the reader to identify and to side with Günther. However, Petra Rau has pointed out quite correctly that the historical novelist needs to create a protagonist with whom the reader willingly identifies. While Katharina Hall correctly points out that traditionally the detective genre has adhered to a dominant depiction of the detective as a representative of truth, morality, and justice. So immediately we have a grey zone here. If we have detectives who work within the remits of the Third Reich, you know, how can they really meaningfully engage with truth, with morality, with justice? So these approaches to both traditional historical and detective novels immediately have to be challenged in the case of Kerr's Bernie Günther, precisely because, as I said, they are set in and deal with Nazi Germany. Günther himself is a German who operates within the unethical, if not downright evil, Nazi system, not only tolerated by the regime, but more often than not actively working for it. While he is not a book-carrying member of the Nazi Party, Günther nevertheless works for the state and operates within its ruthless system. The idea of identifying with or sympathizing with the protagonist consequently needs to be problematized from the start, though this is certainly not done by Kerr himself. So I'll come back to Günther's compromises in order to safeguard his future in due course. But in order to do this, it's important that we first look at the issue of historical verisimilitude in Kerr's novels. So we have to say they are relatively well researched. There is no doubting their grounding in more or less historical fact. Kerr knows his Nazi history. He knows German really well. In fact, he knows German so well that he uses German expressions and translates them verbatim into English, which doesn't work at all. So if you actually read and understand German, you will suddenly read these expressions and you think, yeah, this makes sense. If you're an English native speaker who doesn't understand German, you will read them. I've tried this with colleagues and partners. You read them and you go, I have absolutely no idea what the man is on about. So it's really interesting. So he knows German. He knows Berlin incredibly well. As again, the critic Kramer points it succinctly, he keeps dropping into Hitler's Germany like a local in a time machine. In interviews, Kerr has spoken at length about his interest in history and particularly his obsession with Berlin, where he says, I tramped the streets endlessly. This was before the wall came down, when Berlin was probably the most atmospheric city on earth. I didn't know that I was going to write a thriller, but the more I got into it, the more I realized that I was being the detective exploring the historical Berlin was like working on a case. So he successfully places Günther in the topography of Berlin in a way that enables the reader to follow his progress on a map. So if you're very familiar with Berlin, you can really follow him around there. So this is an example from March Violets, when it says, but Günther says, it was late when I finally drove back to my apartment in Trautenstrasse, which is in Wilmersdorf, a modest neighborhood, but still a lot better than Wedding, the district of Berlin in which I grew up. The street itself runs northeast from Günzelstrasse past Nikolsburger Platz, where there is a scenic sort of fountain in the middle of the square. So Kerr knows in particular the Nazi topography of Berlin, He knows where the main sites of power were, where the Gestapo tortured its prisoners. His novels are atmospheric and certainly conjure up the claustrophobic atmosphere during the Third Reich, the lack of trust, the fear that even close family members might be Gestapo spies, and where everybody, in the cynical words of one of Günther's associates, expects the early morning knock-up from the friendly neighborhood Gestapo man. Even Günther himself becomes the subject of his colleagues' fear and loathing, representative of the wider population's fear of Gestapo surveillance while working for Heydrich in The Pale Criminal. His complicity is constantly underlined, but always excused, exonerated, or treated lightheartedly by Kerr, where it should in fact be problematized a lot more. The Berlin Noir novels are also successful in painting a realistic picture of the constant aggressions against the Jews, for instance, in particular by depicting the all-pervasive propaganda with the Stürmer, the Nazi propaganda newspaper, churning out anti-Jewish headlines, caricatures and articles on a weekly basis. So on this side, you have the quote from the novel. On this side, you have the actual Stürmer cover page from that particular week. And it's exactly the image that Kerr describes here. So again, he did his research. So the quote says, "It was the front page of an old issue of Der Stürmer, Julius Streicher's anti-Semitic publication. A flash across the top left-handed corner of the paper advertised it as a special ritual murder number, not that one needed reminding. The pen and ink illustration said it eloquently enough. Eight naked, fair-haired German girls hanging upside down, their throats slit and their blood spilling into a great communion plate that was held by an ugly caricature Jew." So again, the research in that respect is really quite painstaking. What Kerr describes here in detail is, as I said, the real cover of a particular infamous Stürmer issue from 1934. Just one example of many that aptly illustrate his attention to historical detail and the depth of his research. In other instances, he situates the crimes Günther is investigating alongside real-life political events, the Sudetenkrise of 1938 in The Pale Criminal, for instance, or the black market dealings in the immediate post-war years in A German Requiem, third in the Berlin Noir trilogy. Kerr also uses the biographies of minor Nazi figures that the general public doesn't really know anything about and successfully weaves them into his narrative. So in The Pale Criminal, for instance, he refers to two characters, two SS men called Otto Rahn and Karl Maria Weistor. And when I first read the novel, I thought, well, they're fictional characters. And then actually I started Googling them and found out that they were real. And that some of the things they talk about in the novel were things that they actually made speeches about in reality. So a quick Google search showed me that both were, in fact, real characters involved in occultism and Ariosophy at the time that play a vital role in the narrative of this particular novel, and that further evidences that Kerr did, in fact, do his homework before writing the novels. So we have real Nazi characters are not thrown into the novels haphazardly, but in a more meaningful way, connecting their real-life biographies with the relevant plot lines. So this is all fine. This is all okay. So far, so good. As all three these examples show, the actual factual representation of Nazi Germany in Kerr's novel cannot be doubted. The geography is evocative, the history more or less correct. What is, however, questionable is the use that Kerr puts all of this to, and in order to assess this further, we again need to look at Bernie Günther himself, his main character. So first of all, we have to think, how realistic a character is he? And of course we can say, well, he's a fictional character. He's not supposed to be realistic. But then if you have fiction that deals with the Third Reich, I would argue that there has to be a certain realism. So the answer is very clearly for me, he isn't realistic at all. He's far too outspoken, far too scathing in his criticism of the regime he actually works for. Early on in the novel, he confesses that, "I'm not a National Socialist, but I'm not fucking Cossi either." That's not fucking communist. "I dislike Bolshevism just like I dislike the party." But he also realizes that this puts him in a precarious situation because he says, if you're not for it, you must be against it. So he also realizes that is a dangerous place to be. He states that the country under the Nazis is, in the shit, publicly jokes that Goebbels might be a cloven hoof and refers to Göring as Fat Hermann. He also makes no secret of the fact that he has always supported the old Weimar Republic and the Social Democrats. So saying things like that out loud in Nazi Germany would have immediately earned him a place in the concentration camp. He would immediately have been arrested and send off somewhere, whereas in fact he isn't. He is constantly being wooed by the Nazis to actually work for them, despite him walking around and mouthing off about them, against them. So comments such as these would have seen, as I said, many other men sent for an extended spell in a Nazi prison or concentration camp. But Bernie Gunther seems to stand above Nazi law. So very unrealistic. This might also have to do with Gunther's ability and, importantly, his willingness to play the game. He's able to compromise and always quick to turn situations to his own advantage. Very early on in the novel series, for instance, he ponders that, I guess we've all done well out of National Socialism, haven't we? We're all proper little March violets. So again, these people who benefited from joining the party quickly. A comment such as this immediately questions Gunther's self-confessed and previously cited morality, with a capital M, to emphasize its importance. Throughout the novel, there is not that much evidence of Gunther's morality as he navigates his way through the Nazi regime in his quest for survival. Yes, he tries to speak up for those who are unjustly persecuted. He sometimes tries his best to prevent atrocities, but in the long run, he is used and manipulated by the regime, or rather, he lets himself be manipulated by it quite willingly. He meets Himmler, he meets Göring, he meets and works for Heydrich, and as such, he becomes complicit, of course. Admittedly, if I take a moment to climb down from my own moral high horse, I might, of course, concede that he has little choice in the matter. He is, for instance, blackmailed by Heydrich to spy for him in Dachau, which also means being sent there and being mistreated as an inmate. An interlude that the narrative actually glosses over. And it glosses over it with the rather telling words, how do you describe the indescribable? How do you talk about something that made you mute with horror? That's the only evidence we get in the novels, that he has seen things that have shocked him so much that he can't engage with them. But again, Kerr leaves it at that. He doesn't engage with this anymore at all. So initially starting out as a private investigator, Günther soon rejoins the Kriminalpolizei, the criminal police, an institution he had belonged to previously but left because he disagreed with the regime. So initially, he makes the moral decision, I don't like this regime, I don't want to work for them, I leave the police, but then he gets sucked into it again. And he eventually ends up working in repeated secret missions for Heydrich himself. So not just for the Kriminalpolizei, but effectively for the Gestapo, because that's what Heydrich oversaw, the secret state police. As a member of the notorious Reich Main Security Office in his role as Kriminalkommissar, Günther automatically has the rank of a full lieutenant in the SS, a role he rescinds finally during the summer of 1941 when he requested a transfer to the Wehrmacht in order to not be involved with mass shootings of civilians along the Eastern Front. So that's the one point in the narrative where he makes a choice to not go along with something that the Reich expects from him. So at this point, he clearly does make a moral decision. Nevertheless, his position constantly vacillates between being outside and inside the Nazi machine at the same time. His motivation to ensure justice, in inverted commas, and be, in quotes, a seeker after truth, consequently has to be taken with a big pinch of salt. This is particularly interesting when we take a moment to consider the traditional role of the literary detective, who is generally, unequivocally, on the side of law and justice. That's the whole point. The detective finds, in very similar, simple terms, the detective finds the bad guys get punished, everybody lives happily ever after. So this is really quite turned upside down in these novels. As Hall states, this is considerably complicated in the case of Nazi detectives who are pulled between seeking truth and justice and representing a criminal regime. This issue gains particular prominence when Günther himself kills a criminal during his investigations into the serial killings of young German girls in The Pale Criminal. When he finds out that the renowned Dr. Kindermann is indeed responsible not only for these murders, but also for dressing them up as ritual Jewish killings in order to provoke a program against the Jewish population, Günther kills him in cold blood. Pointing the gun at his head and pulling the trigger once and then several times more. So Kindermann's shooting by Günther is, as Rau says, one of those killings about which the reader is not supposed to raise an eyebrow. As readers, we're expected to, of course, condemn the murders committed by Kindermann and by extension the Nazi regime as unjust, but to consider the murder committed by Günther as just. After all, he's killed a Nazi. That's not a big deal. You know, that's a good thing. That's what we as readers are supposed to conclude. The morality of his action is not questioned once in the narrative, and he doesn't seem conflicted by it either. There is no questioning of himself afterwards, no soul-searching, nothing at all. As readers, we are left in a morally dubious morass. Günther has not killed in self-defense. He has shot a suspect in cold blood, and not just once, but several times over. So he empties his gun into this man, just to make sure. Günther's actions could potentially be excused by the fact that undoubtedly Kindermann would not have been punished by the Nazi regime that was ultimately complicit in his murders. Nevertheless, taking the law into his own hands and meting out his own justice is highly problematic, as he effectively uses the Nazi regime's own weapons of violence. Günther even comments just before shooting Kindermann that in a civilized society, you don't shoot a man in cold blood, to then conclude, except that this was Hitler's Germany and no more civilized than the very pagans venerated by Weistor and Himmler themselves. This is when he pulls the trigger, shooting Kindermann between the eyes. He sort of really makes that clear as well. He's really taking very clear target here and clear aim. But this also shows that this killing puts him on the same level as the uncivilized Nazis he's been trying to fight in the first place. So ultimately then, Günther's actions at time normalized those of the regime around him, and that makes the novels problematic. As Rau puts it so succinctly, reading novels such as Kerr's Bernie Günther series offers the audience the possibility of inhabiting a fascist universe by sharing the perspective of a character who is ostensibly not a Nazi, but so often so deeply compromised in his views and actions that the distinction between monstrous Nazism and ordinary fascism is hard to maintain. At this point, the discerning 21st century reader might say, well, Günther is just a typical postmodern detective who plays with the conventions of the genre. And at the point of Kindermann's killing, this might even be a valid conclusion. Postmodern literary detectives are often implicated in morally dubious decisions, as we will see in my next case study. However, a truly postmodern protagonist would review his actions then, would assess them, would problematize them. At the very least, a truly postmodern author would leave space for his readers to critically assess the protagonist's actions. But we haven't got that chance as readers in Kerr's novels. He moves on too swiftly and too glibly for this to be possible. And this means that his novels remain just historical detective novels written for entertainment and rapid consumption, rather than achieving the label of historiographical metafiction that draws the readers in by involving them in complex moral debates. So there is no space for the moral debates in Kerr at all. So I will now turn for a brief discussion of two other novels that fall into the category of transhistorical crime fiction that is influenced by postmodernism and that shares many characteristics with the meta-historical novel that foregrounds the process of detection, remembrance, recollection, and commemoration in more detail. So I am going to look at these two novels, Bernard Schlink's novel Selbstjustiz of 1987, actually published in English as Self's Punishment in 2004, and Ferdinand von Schirach's Der Fall Collini of 2011, also published in English as The Collini Case in 2012. It's also recently been turned into quite a good film version. They share certain details with Kerr's novel. In one case, we have a detective who decides to take the law into his own hands. In the other, we have a perpetrator who becomes a victim and a victim who becomes a perpetrator. But these two novels engage with history, its legacy, and the responsibilities towards it in a more critical and far more meaningful way, in particular as far as complicity is concerned. Both novels have detectives, in Schlink's case an actual private investigator, in von Schirach's a young attorney, who investigate crimes with links to the past that ultimately ask them highly personal questions about their own life choices. The author's personal backgrounds also seem reflected in their novels. Bernard Schlink is a name you might be familiar with. He's the author of The Reader. So personal backgrounds, both have successful backgrounds in the legal profession as practicing lawyers. Schlink additionally acted as a judge and held a prestigious position as professor of law. Both authors consequently are intimately acquainted with the history of German law, and particularly with its inadequacies when it comes to meting out retroactive justice to Nazi criminals. Von Schirach's novels contains an afterword that explains that In January 2012, a few months after the publication of this novel in the original German, the Federal Minister of Justice in Germany appointed a committee to reappraise the mark left on the Ministry of Justice by the Nazi past. This novel constituted one of the points of reference. So this novel actually helped change a law in Germany that made it possible after 2014 to actually investigate Nazi criminals in a way that hadn't been possible before. So if ever anybody says to you, literature can't change the world, it can. This fact alone undermines the claim that popular fiction lacks importance and influence. Von Schirach's novel clearly was very instrumental in highlighting a loophole in German law that had allowed scores of former Nazis to actually escape just punishment. A detective novel, generally considered an item produced and consumed for light relief and entertainment, has thus been instrumental in a very important case of German coming to terms with the past. But there are also other potentially more personal instances of successfully dealing with the past in von Schirach's novel that also deals with the issue of complicity in a multi-layered and complex way. So to give you a little plot summary of the Collini case, it's a very, very good book. I really urge you to read it. It's fantastic. I'm sure that exists in French translation as well. The Collini case starts with a cold-blooded murder. The Italian guest worker Fabrizio Collini walks into an expensive Berlin hotel and kills a seemingly innocent old man, in cold blood. He shoots him and then afterwards batters him to death as well. I mean, he stomps all over him. It's not very pleasant. Collini does not deny this killing, and in fact, he waits in the hotel lobby for the police to arrive and arrest him. He's clearly committed the murder. He accepts it. He lets himself willingly be taken into custody. He accepts he has committed a crime. He has become a perpetrator. He's willing to pay the price for this. The young and very inexperienced attorney Kaspar Leinen is being told to take on this case, before realizing that the victim, Jean-Baptiste Meyer, was personally well known to him as the benign stand-in grandfather figure who had dominated his youth. He's basically, he was his best friend's grandfather, and he spent most of his youth in Jean-Baptiste Meyer's house. Leinen is that caught in a dilemma. Become an investigator and find the real motivation for Collini's seemingly unmotivated crime, or cherish the memory of Meyer. Leinen starts to investigate and finds out very quickly that Meyer was in fact an SS war criminal, a fact he had managed to keep hidden his entire life. Leinen thus has a choice. He can either defend Collini by destroying Meyer's reputation and uncover a historical crime, or he can turn a blind eye, which would ultimately, of course, make him complicit with Meyer's crimes. As he sets out the case for the defense in court, because obviously he decides to, you know, reveal the truth about Meyer, he knew that today he was going to destroy his childhood. This stark assessment of the situation shows that Leinen realizes that his life will never be the same again. His cherished memories of Meyer will forever be tainted by the fact that the Meyer he once thought he knew and loved had turned out to be a Nazi perpetrator, the SS officer in charge of murdering Collini's father. This reflects real-life parallels for author Ferdinand von Schirach, who during a history lesson at the age of 12 made the devastating discovery that his grandfather was none other than Baldur von Schirach, the infamous leader of the Hitler Youth and responsible for the deportation of all the Jews of Vienna. And he hadn't known about this until he was 12 and found out in school. Not a great place to find this out about your grandfather, right? So, in an interview, von Schirach stated that he considered dealing with the past, both his family's past and the country's as a whole, as his personal responsibility. And he explained that, "I felt the need to finally write something myself about National Socialism, or more precisely, about what the Federal Republic has done with its legacy." Von Schirach's personal family past is paralleled by many Germans, of course, for whom the real difficulty in critically engaging with the Nazi legacy lies in combining the official knowledge of the Third Reich and the Holocaust, acquired through history lessons, documentaries, exhibitions, reading, etc., with the personal recollection of beloved parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, or siblings who might have turned out to be complicit in Nazi crimes. So the Collini case repeatedly blurs the line between the private and the public to start with, but also between the good and the bad in ways that problematize the widely held notion of perpetrators, as in bad, and victims, as in good, highlighting that these divisions are not always conveniently clear-cut. On the one hand, there is Meyer, who from a contemporary perspective was clearly the bad Nazi who had unquestioningly followed orders, given orders himself as well, and obeyed the law of the time. Just as problematically, he saw no need during the post-war decades to critically assess his own past or attempt to atone for his complicity in Nazi crimes. Indeed, he even felt vindicated by German law that until 2012, as I said before, decreed that, in juridical terminology, only the top Nazi leaders were murderers. All others were regarded as accessories to murder. So that was then the law that was changed in 2014. For Leinen, though, Meyer had been nothing but kind and supportive, providing him with loving support and financial support during an otherwise difficult childhood. Because readers access Leinen's recollections of his childhood, they also experience Meyer as a kindly and caring character. The reader, like Leinen, thus has to reconcile the image of the benign Meyer with that of the cold-blooded Nazi killer, in the same way as von Schirach himself had to come to terms with the fact that his grandfather, the so-called, quote, cultured person with the box at the Viennese Opera, had also, quote, orchestrated the deportations of thousands of Jews from Vienna's main station. Both the fictional Leinen and the real-life von Schirach thus have to ask themselves questions. Why had they not known about this before, and why had they not realized this potential for evil in their loved ones? On the other hand, there is the deeply traumatized Collini, who with his own eyes had seen his beloved older sister raped and killed by Nazi thugs, and whose father was murdered in cold blood on Meyer's orders. Collini is, of course, the victim, effectively, with whom we can empathize. Yet he, too, commits a cold-blooded and particularly violent murder. And although he does so to revenge his family and kill the bad guy, he in turn becomes a murderer. Consequently, law and order are turned upside down. The real and original perpetrator, Meyer, can no longer be legally and formally prosecuted and punished because the former victim, Collini, has taken the law into his own hands and effectively become a perpetrator himself. Leinen finds himself defending a clearly guilty man, arguing for his innocence in a way that suggests that there is a hierarchy to crime. One murder deserves punishment, while another, due to circumstances, does not. It is this very ambivalence of law and justice about who should and should not be punished, about taking the law into one's own hands, that also stands at the center of Schlink's self-punishment. So that's the last one I'm moving to. The novel focuses on 60-something Private Eye Gerhard Selb. In the English version, he is called Gerhard Self, for reasons I'll make clear later on, who is investigating a series of cyber hackings in a chemical company. So it's quite a contemporary setting in the late 1990s. The owner of the company is Selb's old friend, Corten. In fact, Corten is not just a friend, he is Selb's brother-in-law, and as such has been family for decades. Selb himself has history. He used to be a criminal prosecutor under the Nazis. But after the war, he is so plagued by a guilty conscience about the complicity of himself and the law in Nazi crimes that he decides to give up his promising legal career and set up a business as a private investigator, which also never flourishes, so he never makes much money. But he feels like morally obliged to do this. Schlink uses this setup to critique the post-war justice system in Germany that allowed former Nazis to simply continue practicing law without holding them accountable for their own role in the Third Reich that had seen them implementing and upholding Nazi law. The novel's continuous preoccupation with the subject of law is already flagged up in the title, which deserves some discussion. So, if we look at this, so we have the German title, which is Selbstjustiz, and the English one, which is Self's Punishment. So the German original, Selbstjustiz, roughly translates as Selbstjustice, not punishment, but justice. And it's a play on the German word Selbstjustiz, which has no equivalent in English, but basically translates into taking the law into one's own hands. This title highlights the novel's main preoccupation, the finding and making accountable of perpetrators who have got away for too long. The question of who metes out justice, when and how. The English title variates from this because there is no translation for the word Selbstjustiz in English. So we have to change from self's punishment. And the question we have to ask here is, of course, whose punishment? The one that self himself will apportion to somebody, or the punishment that will affect himself? So quite an interesting way of dealing with the title. So during the course of the investigation, Selb soon sees himself confronted with a much bigger crime. He uncovers Korten's, his brother-in-law's, company's complicity in Nazi crime, the abuse of forced Jewish labor, the company's culpability in crimes against Jews, which of course goes back by decades but had never been addressed. He also realizes that Korten has used him during an investigation to set up others to be punished for crimes they have not committed. During the course of his investigation, two further men are murdered. Selb's realization, the plot with me as the dupe, set up and executed by my friend and brother-in-law, and I'd been happy not to have to drag him into the trial. He'd used me with contemptuous calculation, does not only mean the end of their friendship. It means, first and foremost, that Selb is forced to confront his own past as a member, former member of the SS and a prosecutor in the service of the Nazis. He has two choices: to ignore this part of investigations, to not further investigate the Nazi crimes of his friend Korten, and to keep his own Nazi past clearly, firmly buried, or alternatively, to confront Korten with his crimes. Korten, in turn, does not shy away from highlighting Selb's own involvement in a case that, in Korten's opinion, makes him culpable, or as culpable. He says, "Did I murder them? Or was it the judge or the hangman? Old Schmalz? Who headed the investigation against Thaiberg and Donke? Who set the trap for Mischke and let it snap shut? We're all entangled in this, all of us, and we have to recognize that and bear it and do our duty." Interesting that we have a perpetrator who is trying to cover his tracks and cover his crimes talking about duty here. Korten, however, perverts the meaning of words such as recognition, bearing it, and doing our duty, as he sees them as synonymous with leaving the past firmly in the past, with not facing up to crimes past or present. He has only contempt for attempts within Germany to confront the Nazi past, which he considers some theatre with trials and verdicts, and he has pity for Selb's attempts to deal with the past. He says, "We are our own fate, and I don't offload anything on powers or forces. You're the one who never sees things through to the end, nor leaves them well and truly alone. My God, Gerd, grow up at last." He does not accept that Selb has come to judge him. His words, "because the perpetrator wants to play judge," are key to the novel that, just as the Collini case, problematizes the often too conveniently drawn line between good and bad, between guilty and innocent, between perpetrator and victim. So we have Gerhard Selb, the former Nazi prosecutor who has spent all of his post-war life trying to atone for his former complicity, and who might consequently have come to be considered that big dichotomy, the good Nazi, has come to judge his brother-in-law, the man who never really left his Nazi past behind, and who is unwilling to even consider his complicity in Nazi crimes. But in his attempts to judge Korten, Selb goes a step further. During a confrontation between the two men at Korten's holiday home in Brittany, his last words to Korten are, "I've come to kill you," before he pushes him off the cliffs. Selb consequently has become once again, possibly more clearly than before, a perpetrator. The detective has not only investigated the past and solved the crime, he has also assumed the roles of both the judge and the executioner, and as such has almost literally been left with blood on his hands. This is the Selbstjustiz of the title, the taking the law into one's own hands, in the same way that Fabrizio Collini in von Schirach's novel had done. In the final installment of the Selb saga, Selb's Mord, which translates into Selb's murder, an older Selb, much weakened by a heart condition, recalls that final confrontation with Korten on the cliff path in Brittany. He says, "I never regretted it. There has been times when I thought I ought to, because it was neither legally nor morally correct, but remorse never set in." So although he says he doesn't feel guilty for it, he does engage with it in a way that Bernie Gunther in Kerr's novel never does. Always an advocate of facing up to the past and atoning for its crimes, Selb lives the rest of his life hiding the murder of Korten. He engages with it himself, but he doesn't come out to the police, for instance. And maybe this is the punishment that the English title, Selb's Punishment, suggests. On the one hand, the punishment Selb himself metes out by killing Korten. On the other hand, his own punishment for having to live with this for the rest of his life. So to conclude, soonish, both the Collini case and Selb's Justiz, or Selb's Punishment, I contend, show the main concerns of successful contemporary crime writing about the Nazi past. In an effort to shed light on the past, these novels turn the figure of the investigator into detective, jury, judge, and in the case of Selb, executioner at the very same time. And a similar thing can be said for the reader. The reader is taking an active part in the investigator's search, in part of the jury, when it comes to assessing these crimes and will ultimately also take the part of the judge. In the culture industry, Theodor Adorno has argued that the culture industry's main aim is to produce pre-digested material that is prescriptive and stops the audience from thinking for itself. But as these two very brief examples from Schlink and von Schirach have shown, contemporary German crime writing on the Holocaust, on the Nazi past, deviates from this a bit. It sheds lights on different angles and perspectives of the Holocaust. It moves away from the established meta-discourse of prescribed victimhood and instead makes readers question their own preconceived notions of right versus wrong, law versus order. So both these novels, contemporary meta-discourses and clear divisions, both these novels question contemporary meta-discourses and clear divisions into good and bad. As Matthew Boswell says, the aim of successful writing about the Second World War and the atrocities of the Nazis is not the desire to transmit direct knowledge of the event itself or to illuminate history as experienced by the victims. Instead, he argues that it is knowledge and revelation in respect of our own lives and societies. And this frequently involves orientating a response to the Holocaust around the dynamics of perpetration and the moral passivity of the bystanders. So both the Collini case and self-punishment engage their readers by wanting us to address and question our own potential for violence, for instance, not in a way to exonerate or excuse the actual perpetrators, but more in an attempt for all of us to question the past and how it is being addressed and commemorated. What would we have done had we been Fabrizio Collini and lived with his traumatic memories? How would we have acted had we been confronted with Corton's brazen self-assuredness on the cliff path in Brittany? So the Collini case and self-punishment are not merely mass-produced formulaic whodunits, but instead novels that do not shy away from asking uncomfortable questions and that help their readers to critically engage with the past. At the beginning of my talk, I set out a number of points of discussion and it might be worth returning to them. So I'm not going to read them out, so you can just look at them there. So I hope that over the past, hopefully nearly hour, I have made a convincing case for the importance of crime novels in providing more knowledge about the Nazi period and more critical thinking about it. Cursed novels are just one example and not necessarily the best. Recently, the German author Christian von Ditfurth, who I mentioned earlier in my very bad French, has launched a new series starting in the 1930s and moving up to the early years of the post-war Federal Republic and focusing on Kommissar Raben, who is a morally upright and staunch defender of what he considers to be right, yet a man who again becomes complicit in a Nazi regime by choice, working for Reinhard Heydrich's secret police in order to protect his half-Jewish wife Lena and their child. So these novels really engage very critically and self-reflectively with Raben's choices in agreeing to work for Heydrich. So von Ditfurth's excellent novels are far less interesting for the crimes they investigate. Their main interest really lies in the moral struggle that Raben engages in on a daily basis, trying to get away from Germany with wife and child or staying there, trying to make a difference. These are questions he constantly asks himself. So even though staying ultimately means fighting on the side of evil. In an interview with Amazon.de, von Ditfurth has explained that he has always been interested in characters that find themselves in a dilemma, that are, in his words, stuck in a moral morass with one foot still, while the other one is still on terra firma. He explains that his novels focus on morals and above all on law and on justice, that this is the main point of his novels. And this is what differentiates them from Kerr, for instance, that focus much more on spectacular murders and Günther's ingenious ways of solving them, rather than moral and ethical discussion about his complicity and guilt. I hope that with my discussion of self-justice and the Collini case, I have presented you with two novels that proactively deal with the past and acknowledge a collective as well as personal complicity in crimes, as well as a responsibility to engage with them head on. These are novels that jolt us as readers out of our complacency by offering surprising or shocking twists that ultimately help us to think about our ingrained notions of right and wrong, victim and perpetrator. And so, although we might consider crime novels popular fiction, light entertainment that does not have the same gravitas of highbrow literature, the contemporary boom in Nazi noir does lend itself perfectly for a critical and thoughtful engagement with the past. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. This was very interesting, stimulating, and I'm sure, and I rarely say that, I'm sure there will be questions.
Well, hello. Thank you for introducing Nazi Noir. I'm very interested in detective fiction because I study the translation of Tarte au Noir. So discovering Nazi Noir was great. I just have two suggestions that maybe will enable you to keep digging. I wonder whether you're aware of the existence of the International Crime Fiction Association, in which scholars from all around the world meet. So every year there are these conferences called Captivating Criminality, and maybe these people might suggest other novels or...
Brilliant. Thank you. I'll try that. Thank you.
Okay, no problem. And I also thought about a book I haven't read yet, but maybe you've heard of John Boyce Beyer translating The Holocaust?
No, I haven't.
So there is this book, but I don't know if she deals with Nazi Noir or whether it could help you investigate.
Brilliant. I will look that up. Translating The Holocaust?
Yes.
Who was the author?
John Bosba Bayer.
Okay. Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you.
Philip?
Yes, thank you. Thanks very much, indeed. Very fascinating, some of these things, and especially very fascinating the idea that some of these books, you can find them in Tesco. Like you get your meal deal, and at the same time, you also get your Nazi Noir.
Your Nazi Noir, exactly.
That says a lot. Okay, I'm not sure if I have questions, but I do want to share some thoughts with you. Mm-hmm. And I come from a film studies background.
Okay.
Film and cultural studies background, and having seen very recently the Oscar nominated film The Zone of Interest,
yes.
Which I'm sure you've seen.
Yes.
You should all definitely see it.
It's
interesting because it's a film on the ethical implications of representing the Holocaust, but at the same time it's broken into the mainstream by being an Oscar runner. Besides all this kind of, let's say, more mainstream and less high modernist, highbrow films. In that respect, I wanted to recommend also to you unless you've seen them already, the Michael Haneke film Das Weiße Band,
yes.
The White Ribbon.
Yes, many years ago. I saw
good.
It. Yeah.
And the HBO TV series The Plot Against America, which is also an adaptation of Philip Roth.
Okay.
The only adaptation of Philip Roth, which I think was actually good, that kind of hit the mark. It's not about Nazis, but it is about the possibility of what if America would have come under the control of people affiliated with the Nazi regime across overseas.
Yeah, I've just started watching The Man in the High Castle, which is a similar thing.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay, good. And... yes, that's one thing. The other was, you mentioned hard-boiled detectives.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very fascinated by Hollywood genres and by especially by film noir. And I do have a fascination with the dark side, a bit like George Orwell would say. And I was actually wondering, I haven't really worked on the roman noir, you know, Dashiell Hammett, etc., which you mentioned, but I have looked at the films, the gangster films of the 30s and then the hardboiled detective films of the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And while all those elements are there, that kind of fascination with the dark side, right? Fascism, narcissism, what was it that Orwell said?
Nationalism,
masochism, etc.
Mm-hmm.
There is at the same time, at least in the films, a flip side to that, which is that... because maybe also of the Hays Code in Hollywood, which didn't allow references to sex and to and violence and prostitution and such things, there was always a moral twist where in the gangster films the man who is after the American dream at any cost, involving also crime and machismo and all that, is punished, receives a moral punishment. And the hardboiled detective is indeed cynical, a bit like the one in Philip Kerr's universe, which makes him kind of not, you know, side with both, not side with, but kind of equate both sides the same, are Bolsheviks, Nazis, you know. He's cynical, but he does have a moral compass, nevertheless, which is what brings him to solving the murder and bringing some kind of justice.
Mm-hmm.
And in that respect, I was also wondering what goes on in the Nazi noirs with the detectives, especially Kurz. Is that an American model that sort of... are these authors trying to beat America at its own game? I think so.
I think, reading Philip Kerr, it certainly does feel like reading sort of Dashiell Hammett a little bit. You also think that sort of deep within, he has a moral compass. He just takes great pains to not let it out, in a way, to not really make that very obvious. I think, I'm not sure if they're trying to beat America their own way. It's obviously part of a wider sort of new wave of noir. It came with the whole Scandi noir, you know, with the Scandinavian TV. Henning Mankell was the first one to start the novels, and Stieg Larsson, the girl with the dragon tattoo, sort of they were sort of supposed to fit into this. And then you get the TV programs, The Killing, The Bridge, etc., etc. So I think it's possibly more a front runner for those new developments that take the noir out of America, that's sort of situated within their own sort of context. I think the problem I have with a lot of those, and in a way especially with Philip Kerr, he does it really cleverly in many respects, but he also exoticizes the whole Nazi stuff in a way that is deeply problematic.
It
because
makes it
of
more fun, right?
Exactly. That makes it more palatable. And like you said before, that's what you find in the supermarkets now. You get it is actually exactly opposite the meal deal shelf as well.
Sure.
So you really get the meal deal here and you grab your book there, and it shows sort of preoccupation in Britain with sort of war and fascism light. In a way, which I think a lot of these novels try to do, a lot of the Anglophone ones. The German and the Italian ones are a lot more introspective and a lot more self-critical.
So is this detective maybe then, although it could be anachronistic to say so, is he maybe some kind of a political proto-Thatcherite?
Probably, yes. It's actually a nice idea. I'll have to explore that a bit more. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Please. It's not a question, but it's a recommendation for a book, a Nazi noir, a French book. I was not sure, so I checked on the internet, and it's by Jean-Christophe Granger. Maybe you know the name.
No.
Jean, like Jean. And
yeah.
Christophe, like Christophe.
Yeah.
And Granger, R-A-N-G-N-E.
Yeah.
And it's called Les Promises.
Les Promises. Okay.
And I think it's a thriller.
Okay.
It's a historical thriller.
Okay.
And it might be interesting if you want to...
I shall check that out. Thank you very much.
Yes, it's set during the war in Berlin. Yeah.
Okay.
Where wealthy German women regularly meet in a club and drink champagne and ignore the international situation and... but the killer is on the loose.
Okay, fantastic.
And one of them is killed, so there's a psychoanalyst who's investigating.
Mm-hmm.
What was the quote from Orwell? Was it in an essay he wrote about fascist sensibility? Or?
He wrote two. And at the moment, I can't remember which one this is taken from. There's one, The Decline of English Murder, and the other one is Orchids for Miss Blandish, where he basically laments the fact that, because in Britain you have this tradition, Britain is sort of the home of the detective story. You have your Sherlock Holmes, you have your Agatha Christie in the interwar years, but that's all quite tame. But he says that this is nice, and we're losing the nice crime because of this wave of really brutal, gruesome, very graphic crime coming from the US. So he was very, very critical of this new wave of American noir, for instance. So it's from one of those two essays he wrote.
Well, I really enjoyed your talk. I really enjoyed the presentation of the two types of approaches, and And I always liked the fact that you were able to point out a case when literature really changes the world. There are a few examples. There's another one which has nothing to do with this period, but another one by Chase Ribou, the one who wrote the Hotento Venus. She changed the way they looked at Jefferson's mistress, if I remember well, because of the novel, you see. So that's really... that's always a cheerful thought.
I know. I think we need to celebrate that, because we're all constantly told that literature doesn't matter. It's something you do for entertainment at home, but surely you can't earn a living with it. So I think we need to emphasise that literature does indeed sometimes change the world.
The Jungle by Upton Sinclair also helped change the working conditions at the slaughterhouses in Chicago.
And I was going to say, when you were talking about the first type of detective, you know, saying, oh, he's not, you know, he should be he's no longer the straight guy, but it's no longer the case anyway with postmodern fiction. It's been postmodern, but you did point this out in the second case, because it's. As you were saying, even the hard-boiled detective is not completely straight in a way. So that's it. I didn't really have a question. Sorry. I had a question, but something I didn't fully understand. But that's not very interesting.
You said there was no space for a moral debate in Kerr, for example, but nevertheless there is food for thought, I guess. Implicitly, there must be a space in between the lines.
You see, I don't think there is.
No.
I think... There is a famous quote from Ian Fleming about his James Bond novels, which are obviously similarly questionable, where he says these are not political novels. They are written for entertainment. They are written for warm-blooded heterosexuals waiting in airport lounges. And every time I read a Kerr novel, I have to think of that quote. I think that's sort of his target audience. I think he doesn't expect his readership to have any real historical knowledge of or interest in the war, just a very superficial one, just to go back to the meal deal kind of thing. He doesn't really want to entertain, he wants to entertain. So things happen so quickly that it's never even the space for you as a reader to just think, now I pause, you know, and think about what I just read. It just moves along straight away. And so maybe I'm just very unkind, because they're also so sexist and the depiction of women is so questionable that I'm just really not very much Philip Kerr's friend. But I really don't think he allows the reader that space to really critically engage. He just wants the reader to be pulled along by a rollicking narrative and not really think about the issues in a meaningful way.
It sounds as though... And again, I'm coming from as a novice to this, so you're teaching me a lot. It sounds like a lot of these novels are following certain conventions.
Mm-hmm.
Are there authors who, in some way or another, break new ground in escaping from the conventions and
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I would say so. So I would say Kerr is really formulaic. It's really formulaic crime fiction. So in a way, I would say authors like the one I mentioned at the end, Christian von Ditfurt, I think he does break the conventions, because as I try to say, and it's of course very difficult, the series is supposed to last until the early years of the Federal Republic, but he's only written the first two, so we've only just reached 1935 in them. They don't seem sort of in terms of form and content, they don't really seem to break with tradition, but what they really draw out a lot more is the ideology that underpinned everything, that sort of swept people up. Whereas in Kerr, what is in the foreground is the crime. Solving the crime, not really engaging with the ideology that underpins the Nazi Reich. In von Ditfurth's novel, the star of the show, so to speak, in inverted commas, is really the ideology. Mm. What happened? How did it build up slowly? What were the choices people did? How did people justify those choices to themselves, more even than to others? And I think in that respect, those novels really break new ground for me.
Which I guess is what separates a film like Schindler's List from, again, the recent one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The... I'll let, if there's someone, we've got a remark online, if you can speak now, Isabel.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much, Christine.
Hi, Isabel.
I have a question, and my friend has a question as well, about the reception of those novels. But first, I haven't read the book, but I saw the Collini case. Mm. And in the Collini case, in the film, the younger attorney is a Turkish, I mean, his mother, and he's adopted by this Nazi, ex-Nazi, And I would like to know if it's something which is added in the film, or if it's like that in the original, because there is this sub theme of immigration, Turkish immigration, and so on, and the Nazi making up by adopting this young Turkish boy, who is the son of his housekeeper, I think, or something like that, bringing him up and paying for his studies to become a lawyer, and so on. And there is also more or less a love story involved as well.
Yeah, I had completely forgotten about that with the film. It's not in the book, no. That was just purely added in the film.
Yeah, and so but because with the importance of Turkish immigration in Germany as well, it adds another layer to the story as well.
Yeah, and it's actually it's interesting. I've just read one of the Italian novels, the Bruno Morchio, and that also connects the narrative of the fascist past in Italy with another narrative strand set now that deals with immigration into Italy and illegal immigrants, for instance. But the Collini case, the novel, doesn't do that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you had another question, you said?
Yes, hello. I'm with Isabel.
Hi.
I would like to ask you a question about how far have you related the period in which the novels were written, from the earlier ones and then the more recent ones, with the fact that the distance that is covered between us and the end of the Second World War is crucial for how much people are willing or it was acceptable to talk about all this thing and guilt and complicity.
That's interesting. I hadn't actually yet considered that yet. So that's a really interesting point. Thank you. I think I would generally say that increasingly what we see coming out of German literature is very, very, very self-reflective and very soul-searching, which possibly has to do with the general sort of attitude of historical openness and acknowledgement of sort of collective guilt that has been in Germany since the early 1990s. So that's what makes those novels slightly more successful to me than the British ones that seem to be dealing with sort of the Nazi period as a purely historical period that doesn't really have relations to the present day anymore. But that's a really interesting point. I'll think about that a bit more. Thank you. I keep staring at this. I should look at the camera, shouldn't I? You're not in there. You're there. Hello.
Hello.
I've got a second question, if it's possible.
Sure.
I'm quite interested to know how and why you first personally became interested in the subject of looking at Nazi noir and their historical relevance, if you like.
I can't remember. I think I read one of those novels. I think I read the Bernhard Schlink novels because I rate Bernhard Schlink very highly as a novelist. And I think I read the Self novels, the trilogy, and I thought, whoa, they're really quite fantastic. can I find, and naively thinking, oh, I wonder if there is anything like it. And then, yes, hundreds of pounds spent on books later and groaning bookshelves, there are a lot of those books. So I think that's what really started me. And then the Collini case came out, and I saw that book when it came out, and I read it straight away, and I watched the film, and I thought, yeah, that's something to really work on. And I've now realized that there are some other people working on similar things, but it's not yet something that has really hit the mainstream in British academia, certainly. Mm. But I think that's what started it. I think it was the Bernard Schlink.
Mm. Right, that's very interesting. Thank you.
If we come back to the breaking of the convention that you pointed out, I was thinking that's a very that's kind of very contemporary, this merging of detective fiction becoming more mainstream, like historical fiction is invading everywhere, and we've got a merging of all this. And I was looking at the book covers as well, wondering, and one of them, I was wondering if in Germany the books were marketed as thrillers. There's one of them, there was a white book cover. It's among the last ones that you showed us. It was with a German title.
Oh, the from Ditford.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes, because the one on the left.
Oh, sorry, this one here.
Yeah, that's not. I mean, I don't know Bernard Schlink. He's not classified as. He's not a specialist in detective fiction,
no,
is he?
No, he's not.
He's a mainstream one, so that's why.
Yeah.
But the other one.
That's the English version.
That's the English version.
Yeah.
And what, I'm sorry, I must have missed it. Why are there two names on the cover?
Oh, because they I think they wanted to do the wordplay, because you get the wordplay in Serbs Justitia with the...
No, I mean...
Oh, there. Okay.
On the right-hand side.
Yes, because he wrote the first one together with somebody else, but it's not quite clear how much involvement from Walter Popp there is. And the other two, he then only Bernard Schlink's name appears.
Okay.
Yeah, but I think the important thing with Schlink is no, he's not a crime novel writer at all. He's normally writing what is considered more highbrow fiction, so The Reader, for instance. But the important thing is that pretty much everything Schlink writes has to do with engaging with the past and with critically, self-reflectively engaging with the past.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when he started writing that trilogy of crime novels, it was supposed to be a bit of a departure to write something more light-hearted and more fun, and lo and behold, he's engaging with coming to terms with the past in it as well. He can't get away from it.
Thank you. Yeah.
Is there a genre that is similar to Nazi noir, which refers to another fascist system? Maybe I'm thinking about China. Maybe.
I don't know. There probably is. I think, in fact, I just saw something on Amazon the other day that does seem to be set in Shanghai during the war. And, of course, I use the umbrella term Nazi noir, but I'm looking at texts from Italy, which are obviously not Nazi noir, they're fascist noir. So I think in my eventual book introduction, I will have to qualify that term a little bit more. So you get quite a lot of engagement actually coming out of Italy, even in something as popular as Andrea Camilleri's Inspector Montalbano. There is actually one installment, I can't now remember the title of it, but there is one that also goes back to the fascist period in Italy. So you get them in Italy. You don't seem to get them in Spain. You don't seem to get them in Austria. There seem to be certain hotspots. So you get the general sort of English language engagement with it in a more sensationalist manner, but then you get the engagement of some of the, key players when it comes to Nazism, fascism, like Italy, like Germany, and where you have this quite sort of really critical assessment of the time. I mean, the ones from Italy, they are really, the ones I've read so far, they're brilliant, because you have these policemen who are desperate to work as policemen. They say, that's what I am. I am a policeman. And then I just want to work as a policeman. And then suddenly they find themselves working and upholding a fascist state. And then some of the later novels are then set post-war, where they're being chased by the partisans or the former partisans and the communists, saying, you know, you were a fascist collaborator. And they go, no, I was only a policeman. And where they have to come to terms with their own complicity themselves. But there probably are some other examples. I think at some point I'll have to draw the line of which ones I look at.
If I may continue, you talked about the second type. You said they're more soul searching. Mm. There's more soul searching, and I was wondering if there was are these third person narratives, are they first person narratives? How is this? Are they chronological within the narrative? How does it, in the story? Is it in the way the narrative is conveyed? The story is conveyed.
I think.
Is there anything there at all, or?
I think the majority of them are sort of third person. Mm-hmm.
With an omniscient or restricted point of view? Or?
With sort of certainly the focaliser on the detective, and you get sort of the detective's innermost thoughts, but even though it's written in a third person narrative. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I think the majority of that. I'm just trying to think. I can't think of any that are written in the first person.
Okay. And the unfolding of the investigation is chronological.
Yeah. I think the Philip Kerr is first person. I think it's first person, which would then lend itself for the self-reflection and introspection that isn't there. So I think, I hadn't even thought of that.
In French, it's la trilogie Zell, which doesn't mean much.
No.
We are losing something.
Oh, okay.
Because there's no self in French.
Yeah, that would be difficult, wouldn't it? Would be something like mem something,
Zelle banquette de lui-même, or something like this.
Yeah. Okay, was there another question or remark? A contribution in any form?
It's so clear that I'm
I take that.
Shall we leave it at that? Well, thank you again very much.
Thank you
very much for coming in.